This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Well, for the first time since 2010, there's an open seat for lieutenant governor this year, and it's a race where the two major party candidates view the role of government very differently. As part of VPR's ongoing coverage of the 2016 campaign, my guest today is the Republican candidate seeking the office, Randy Brock. In his political career, Mr. Brock served a term as state auditor. He's represented Franklin County in the state Senate. He was also the Republican candidate for governor in 2012. Randy Brock, welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much. Great to be here, Bob.
And you can join the conversation here at Vermont Edition. You can give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. What are your thoughts about the race for lieutenant governor? Are there some key issues that you would like to see the candidates discuss during this campaign? Let us know. You can always send us an email at vermontedition@vpr.net. Or give us a call, 1-800-639-2211. Let's start off with your new radio ads. You've started running a couple of ads that call into question the character of your opponent, David Zuckerman, the Democrat progressive candidate. You say he can't be trusted to be elected lieutenant governor, and here's part of that ad.
He's billed the taxpayers for mileage he never drove. He's introduced legislation for personal financial gain. He's a strong supporter of laws that would expose our school children to dangerous diseases by discouraging vaccinations. He's equated the fight for marijuana legalization to the fight against racism. He's allowed his campaign aide to circulate false and despicable accusations of racism against me. He's tried to suppress free speech because he did not like the speaker's views. And recently, he passed off an anti-Semitic remark as a joke. This is no laughing matter. That's why I ask for your vote in November. The job of lieutenant governor, a heartbeat away from being governor, is too important to elect someone you can't trust.
That's a new radio ad from Republican candidate for lieutenant governor Randy Brock. There are huge issue differences between you and Mr. Zuckerman. You disagree about the budget. You disagree on tax policy. You disagree on health care, the legalization of marijuana, gun control. With all of those issue differences, why go after the character of your opponent?
Because ultimately, that's what this and almost every other political race is really about. It is about character. It's about who you trust. It's about who you think will represent you well. Character is the core issue in all of this. And the ads and the things that I've included in those ads are contrast. They're not negative. They're contrast. They represent things that my opponent has either said or done, and they're on the record and they're well documented. And not just in those ads. I believe in those ads comments that are either racially insensitive or simply improper, and he's continued to do it since this ad was recorded. In at least one other incident that is just disturbing about the pattern that I'm seeing.
So what do you say to those folks who hear these ads and say, you know, these are just negative ads that are designed to tear down your opponent?
These are facts. They're designed to make sure that the public is aware of issues that are important. Because, you know, ultimately, when you vote for a lieutenant governor, you're really potentially voting for a governor. We know that five times in Vermont history, it's happened that the lieutenant governor has become governor suddenly. This is not a minor office that you ignore and that you simply don't pay attention to what underlies the person that you're voting for. I think the public deserves to be informed. And as I say, every one of these things is on the record.
So you don't view this as a negative ad?
I view it as a contrast ad. I view it as an ad to inform people about the contrast and to point out information that the public can look at and judge for itself.
So this morning we asked David Zuckerman to respond to your ad, and this is what he said.
Well, it's extremely disappointing. We've been running an issues-based campaign the way Bernie did across the country. He was such an inspiration for me, and we wanted to stay positive and we'll continue to stay positive. I guess my opponent is feeling desperate. He's taking a chapter from the right-wing playbook, and he's wildly out of step with most Vermonters on main issues like the minimum wage, affordable housing, climate change, and more. So instead of telling everyone what he believes in, he's taken to attacking my character.
Did you come to the conclusion that it would be difficult to win this race if you didn't run an ad like this?
No, absolutely not. You know, I've run campaigns for, 12 years in Vermont, Bob. I've never mentioned race at all in any of those campaigns. I've never raised the issue. And I wouldn't raise the issue until David Zuckerman's paid campaign aide, a person who's with him at every debate and every event, began distributing material that actually, in clear terms, called me someone who tacitly supports racism and who uses racism for my own political purposes. That's a bald-faced lie. And I would be remiss. I'd be remiss to my supporters. I would be remiss to Vermonters if I sat idly by and just said nothing about it. I never raised that issue.
Let's go to our callers and talk to TJ, who's calling from Burlington. Hey, TJ, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks. I just wanted to ask Mr. Brock, I've seen him distance himself from Donald Trump in the past, but with these radio ads, I'm seeing him pretty closely aligned to the same type of strategy in terms of character assassination and really wild mischaracterizations of his opponents. So just wanted to rectify that where this candidate stands, actually. It's a little confusing from his collegial past.
All I can say is listen to what those statements are in the ad and look at the detailed source of each one of those. And the source is the Zuckerman campaign. These are things that David and David's staff have done. I'm not raising things that can't be fact-checked by the press, and I expect that the press will fact-check each and every statement in that ad.
You've made it clear for some time that you do not support Donald Trump.
I have, and I've said, months ago, when he was still one of many contenders in the race, that bullying, bigotry, xenophobia, and buffoonishness is nothing that we should look for in a president. And I've been very strong, and I've been criticized, indeed, by some folks in my own party for my particular stand. But this is a stand of conscience, and it's one that I've been very consistent on for a long period of time.
Well, given that feeling and that stand, can you clarify for us whether or not there were some tweets from Donald Trump at your website?
Yeah, someone tweeted from my website. It was not us. We didn't do it. We discovered it quickly, and we shut it down.
Somebody hacked into your website?
Someone, I believe, did, yes. Again, it was nothing. It was not one of my campaign staffers. It's nothing that we believed in, supported. We discovered it, and we shut it down immediately.
Let's go back to our listeners and talk to Lyle in Morrisville. Hey, Lyle, welcome to the program.
Hi there. Hello there. Can you hear me?
We can.
Okay, my comment is this. David Zuckerman is just another socialist, and I don't think we need him in Montpelier, period. Socialism hasn't worked all around the world, and it won't work here in Vermont. I know Randy. I've known him personally. I campaigned for him when he ran for governor. Zuckerman supports legalizing pot. And already in Colorado, they've seen a tremendous increase in the number of individuals who have had accidents and people who have been injured because of pot smoking. And I just think, you know, we need to stop and think about where we're going in Vermont and stop these progressive socialist Democrats from trying to run our state anymore.
Okay, Lyle, we appreciate your phone call. You know, I think that's what some people are looking at here is they see the issue differences are so significant in this race that they wonder why this kind of radio ad.
Well, the issue differences are the differences that we've certainly talked about, Bob, on this show. We've talked about it in debates. We certainly are going to continue to talk about it in debates. But ultimately, the issue differences are stark. People will make up their minds on those issues, but the underlying issue, as I mentioned before, is the character and trust of the individual filling the office. Everyone doesn't agree on every single issue. It's rare that you'll find a candidate with whom you agree about everything. But those issues are things that we certainly have ample time and will spend ample time debating and have thus far. But these other issues, the issues that have been raised in this campaign by my opponent, are issues that I think need to be raised to the public.
Let's go back to our listeners and talk to Asfar, who's calling from South Burlington. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for having me.
And what's on your mind today?
So basically, I wanted to ask Mr. Brock, me being a Muslim American in the Vermont community, I wanted to ask him, especially in today's day with all the rhetoric and talk about Muslims and today's politics surrounding Donald Trump and other Republicans, what exactly would you, Mr. Brock, do, or how would you work with the Muslim community in Vermont?
I would work with every community, every group, every ethnicity, every religion in an absolutely equal and open way. I have no concerns about people of the Muslim faith. I've served with people who are Muslim when I was in the service. I've worked with them in the corporate world. People are people. And I strongly believe in that one of the problems that we have right now is the overemphasis on diversity and the underemphasis on inclusion. Inclusion, I think, is extremely important, and including people of the Muslim faith and of people of every race, ethnicity, religion, sexual orientation in the public discourse, and treating people well, and treating people equally, and treating people as friends and neighbors. That's what really counts, and that's what I would do.
So help us understand in your mind the difference between diversity and inclusion.
Well, the issue of diversity and the notion of diversity, the notion that people are different, that's absolutely true. There's no question about that. But what I'm saying is if we emphasize the notion that we have this community over here and that community over there and another community over there and we have to treat them differently, well, the answer in my mind is we don't. We need to treat people as people. They're all our neighbors. They may look different. They may have different beliefs. They may have different people that they love. But they're all our friends and neighbors and should be treated that way.
Let's talk to Mary, who is calling from Moncton. Hi, Mary. Welcome to the program. Mary, are you there? No. Well, I think we lost Mary for a little while. Hopefully, Mary will call back. Let's talk about the economy. I know the last time you were on the program, you said the top three issues in this campaign, jobs, jobs, and jobs. You say you want to change the attitude of state government when it comes to economic development. So what specifically would you recommend doing that the Shumlin administration has not done?
Well, I think one of the major things that I would do is reaching out to business. You know, we talk about spending time looking for new businesses to come to Vermont and to expand in Vermont. But at the same time, the resources that we devote to that effort are relatively small in comparison to efforts that we spend doing other things in the state. And I would review that. I would review whether or not we could do a better job of our business outreach and of our marketing and really branding. And that goes much, much broader than what we're talking about here. I want to do that, though, not by creating additional programs and not by creating additional expense. I think we have to watch what we spend. And I would look at how we can create either efficiencies or different ways of doing things or reprioritization of our activities in order to create what we need to do that. But one of the things that I would also do that doesn't cost any additional money is I would go talk to our major employers and begin an open and continuing dialogue. And I know the administration will say that they do it, but time after time, I go to some of our larger businesses in Vermont. Last night, I was, again, up in the Northeast Kingdom, and I talked with one of the top leaders of a company that employs over 500 people in the kingdom. And I asked him, when was the last time a senior leader in state government came to you to talk about what your needs are and what government can do or stop doing that would help you and help your business succeed. And he said nobody's come to see him in the last several years. That's a recurring theme that I've heard elsewhere. I was in St. Johnsbury. I talked to two of the largest businesses there. Oh, this is 2 or 3 weeks ago. Again, one employs about 300 people. One is about employs about 200. The same message. There's not the outreach. There's not the contact. There ought to be. And that's so very important because it's not just a case of our going out and attracting new businesses, which is always difficult in tough economic times. The real trick is we got to retain the businesses that we have. We've got to stop the outflow of jobs. We've got to encourage businesses that are here that if they're going to do some expansion, that we want them to expand here, not expand in North Carolina or Georgia or wherever else. And that takes hands-on contact. And one of the jobs that I think I can do well is as an ambassador to people who create and maintain jobs, both within Vermont and also outside of Vermont.
We've got Mary back on the line, Mary from Moncton. Hey, Mary, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me on. My question is for Mr. Brock, and I'm wondering, given what he claims to feel about Donald Trump and the disastrous campaign run by the Republicans, why he would at this point move to character assassination and away from an issues-based campaign. So that's one question. The other question is, if he wanted to attack Mr. Zuckerman has a long, successful career in the legislature working bipartisanly on various bills. I'm just wondering why he doesn't actually take on Mr. Zuckerman on the level of issues.
Okay, Mary, thanks very much for your phone call.
I do not believe that quoting a candidate's own words and actions is character assassination. I believe it is a contrast, and I believe it is simply advising Vermonters who might not know some factual issues that are relevant. I believe it's relevant to know that a candidate has billed the taxpayers for driving to and from Montpelier when he hasn't done so. I believe that's important to know. I believe that if a candidate introduces legislation that has a strong appearance of being of personal interest and a way to add to personal income, that's something that Vermont taxpayers ought to know.
Do you think if someone's a teacher in the legislature that they should be voting on things like state aid to education?
I think that everyone has to make a judgment as to what is or is not relevant to what they're voting on. Voting on bills that have broad applicability is different from voting in a way that is so narrow as to give the appearance of a clear conflict of interest. And that's what we're talking about.
Today in the program, our guest is the Republican candidate for Lieutenant Governor, Randy Brock. Our phone number, 1-800-639-2211. When we come back, we're going to continue to talk about the economy and other issues. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Today, our guest is the Republican candidate for Lieutenant Governor, Randy Brock. Our phone number, 1-800-639-2211. We were talking about the economy just before we took the break. I'm wondering, you know, there have been allegations of massive fraud with the EB-5 program in the Northeast Kingdom. Yep. A lot of that is being sorted out now. But I'm wondering, what are your thoughts about this program in general? Is it a good way to encourage business development in Vermont?
Well, EB-5 has certainly had its scandals, not just in Vermont, but elsewhere in the country. And I think it absolutely needs to be cleaned up. I think that better internal controls and more vigorous oversight and a regular program of auditing should be instituted in any EB-5 plan. Now, that being said, there are those who will say, well, EB-5 gives people the right to jump the line on the basis of wealth in order to get a green card to get into this country. And that is an issue that's important to think about. But at the same time, my understanding is that people who are potential green card holders who come in under EB-5 have to pass all of the regulatory, the background checks, the security checks that would be required of any immigrant coming into the United States. One of the things that I have been thinking about is that it's extremely important, given what's happened in the Vermont Regional Center with EB-5, that we do everything we can to ensure that those investors from abroad who may be harmed, whose green cards are in jeopardy through no fault of their own, be made whole. And I look to our federal officials in the Senate and Representative Welch in the House to do everything they can through the federal government to make that happen. For EB-5 going forward, one of the things that I think we should think about is revamping Vermont's EB-5 program entirely to move it out of the high-risk private sector that it's been in and to focus EB-5 on what we have as a real need, and that's infrastructure. We're going to have to spend hundreds of millions of dollars to clean up the lake based on being faced with what the EPA wants. We also have aging roads, bridges, and highways and limited bonding capacity. EB-5 is a way to do that, to provide the funding in the short run to do it, and no new laws are necessary to do it. The original federal legislation authorizing EB-5 specifically includes state infrastructure as part of it. The Pennsylvania Turnpike Authority is using it, the Southeastern Pennsylvania Transit Authority, the state of Washington, the Tappan Zee Bridge, for crying out loud, is using EB-5. And I would take it one step further. We have EB-5 investors who invest in Vermont projects and then go live in Florida or California or someplace else. Why? Because nobody's asked them to become Vermonters. We open our doors to people who are immigrants, and immigration is part of our culture, part of our national imperative. Wouldn't it be nice to have a few immigrants who are actually wealthy, who could add to the richness of our communities, who could add kids to our schools, who could open businesses here in Vermont? We should go to the next step and ensure it's not just their money we want, but we want people to come here and prosper. We need to increase our population.
Generally, you talk about the need to have less government regulation for the businesses that are operating in the state of Vermont. Is this a case where you think more regulation is needed to make sure that there isn't fraud?
I think that one of the things about any free market, a free market is always a market that somebody is looking at to make sure that it's being operated honestly. That is just common sense. When you have any government program that is not – that does not have effective oversight, it's a program that is ripe for the potential of fraud. And my entire career has been spent largely in the area of preventing, investigating, and mitigating fraud. And so I'm very cognizant of what needs to be done. I'm very cognizant of the failures in the EB-5 program that we have right now.
What do you think of the practice of the government offering tax incentives to businesses to come here or tax credits? Is that a worthwhile goal? Is that a good use of taxpayer money?
Well, one of the things that I see is kind of a myth in the thinking that sometimes some segments of our legislature engage in is that if we offer, let's say, a tax credit for a business to come here that is not here and that would not come here, that we're enticing someone to do something that they wouldn't do anyway, that we somehow have a cost or an expense. And the issue is we don't, because if you give a tax credit for taxes that you would never otherwise collect anyway, you're not giving away anything. It's something that hasn't happened and that will not happen. Now, the trick, and this is where better oversight and better regulation, is to ensure that you're not incenting something that's going to happen whether you incent it or not. But if we, let's say, look at an industry that's not operating here in Vermont, there's no evidence that industry or business was even thinking about coming to Vermont to open a new business, and we say to them, we're going to give you for this billion-dollar business that you're going to establish here, you're going to hire 10,000 people in Vermont, to use a wild example. And in order to do that, we're going to give you a 10-year tax holiday if you do it. Well, the point is, if we give that 10-year tax holiday, it might be worth $50 million. we're not giving away anything because they only get the money if they actually deliver what they promised to deliver, which is taxes over and above that $50 million. We can only gain in a situation like that. We can't lose.
Let's shift gears and talk about health care for a moment. The Green Mountain Care Board is looking at a plan to dramatically change how health care is paid for in Vermont. It's a plan that's called All Payer. It would reimburse health care providers based on the quality of care and positive health care outcomes instead of the current fee-for-service plan that reimburses for every visit and every procedure. Do you support this approach?
It's too early to tell because we don't know enough about it. You know, we've had a – this is a program that's been negotiated in secret for a matter of months, and we're just getting the first documents that really explain what this plan consists of, and the devil is in the details. It's a plan that does not exist anywhere else in the country, which immediately raises the suspicion of the first-in-the-nation problem that's plagued us before. I would not want to be the first in the nation to have a heart transplant, for obvious reasons. And so we need to look very carefully at what's in this. And some of the fine print that's beginning to emerge from the plan does give us a question that we really want to look at very, very carefully in terms of what that means. Particularly, there's one provision relating to payment of providers of Medicaid that would appear to give the board the authority to lower the payments paid to Medicare. And that may be that I think would be of grave concern to providers and to seniors. But it's too early, I think, because we need to do, I think, a lot more analysis of that detail to see exactly what those things mean before we come to a judgment. Now, I understand that the federal government is going to give us a sum of money to help through a transition to this plan. But the federal government has never been a particularly trustworthy partner. Is very often in programs, the federal government gives a sum of money for a period of time, and then the federal money dries up and the state has to pay for it. We have to think through very carefully the law of unintended consequences of, do we adopt a program that 2 or 3 or 4 years down the road becomes a huge burden on our budget with no clear source of how we're going to assume that load?
I think the Green Mountain Care Board estimates that about 85% of all health care expenditures in Vermont are for people with chronic illness. And they say this new plan is needed to reimburse health care providers to try to keep these people healthy and to try to prevent people from getting chronic illness in the first place. 85% is huge.
It's an absolutely huge number. And that notion of keeping people healthy is something I strongly support. We've got some programs, even before this has started, at some of our hospitals in Vermont that recognize that and are moving very aggressively. Northwestern Medical Center, for example, has been very successful in providing case management of people who have chronic illnesses to ensure that they do go to the doctor, that they do take their medication, that they do participate in wellness programs. That saves money. That saves hospital budgets. And that's even in our fee-for-service system that's being done. We need to do more of that because you're absolutely right. That is a major driver of cost. At the same time, when we talk about shifting our payment system, we're talking about shifting payments that for something that represents the sixth of our economy. I think based on where we went before with this 3-year exercise into single payer, we need to tread carefully and we need to understand what we're doing and understand the implications of it before we jump off the cliff.
Now, the supporters of All Payer would say, hey, it's optional. So let's try it out and see what happens. What about that?
The question is it in fact optional? And again, the devil is in the details. And when you get into the fine print, you'll forgive me for having a degree of skepticism because I remember someone saying, if you like your doctor, you can keep him.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Allison in Winooski. Hi, Allison. Welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hi. You're on the air, Allison.
Hi, I would like to ask a couple of questions. Number one is, as far as the unemployment rate, all the reports say, oh, yeah, we have a really high unemployment rate in Vermont, but these numbers aren't taking into account that a lot of the people, like me and so many others I know, we're filling those jobs because they're part-time jobs. We have to work 2 or 3 jobs to be able to survive. And we're always saying, oh, businesses need to pay more. The businesses. Well, but what are we supposed to be doing to lower the cost of living to make it more livable in Vermont? Secondly, and more importantly, I keep hearing so many of the politicians everywhere saying, "Oh, you know, we're going to be your leaders." You're not our leaders. You are our elected public servants. And why are you perpetuating this lie? I think it should change, and I think it should change in Vermont with reminding the country that you're not our leaders. We, the people, are the leaders. You are being hired to carry out the mandates that we prescribe.
Okay, Allison, thanks very much for your phone call. We've just got a little bit of time left, so let's address the unemployment rate and why you feel that might not be representative of the real job market out there.
Well, I don't think it is representative. We show a relatively low unemployment rate, but that neglects to include the number of people who stopped looking, the number of people who are unemployed, and, of course, the number of people who've left. But if you take the pure Bureau of Labor Statistics numbers, we show a smaller workforce than we had at the beginning of the Great Recession in December of 2007. And we also show a smaller number of people in Vermont who are actually working since that date. That's the thing that points to the fact the unemployment rate is not what it really means.
Election day is exactly 4 weeks away. Voters will be electing a new lieutenant governor in Vermont, Republican candidate Randy Brock. Many thanks for being on the program today. Coming up next, I'll talk with independent U.S. Senate candidate Jerry Trudell about his top campaign priorities. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. This week, in addition to talking to the lieutenant governor candidates, we're also airing interviews with the candidates running for U.S. Senate. Democratic incumbent Patrick Leahy and Republican challenger Scott Milne are on the ballot, as well as three other candidates. And I spoke to one of them earlier this week, independent candidate Jerry Trudell. I asked Trudell what he would like listeners to know about his biography and career.
Well, I have had a mixed career. Check out my art on JerryPilot2016 on Instagram. I'm a pilot, aerial photographer. I also am a Getty Images contributor. I specialize in aerial photography of Vermont, New York, San Francisco, and Lake George. I published posters, a series of posters for Killington Resorts, and I had at one point a note card series in over 100 stores in the state of Vermont. Now, the other part of my career is volunteerism. It's right on my website and in my resume. I have done a lot of community service, make a long story short.
You mentioned your website, JerryTrudell4Senate.com.
Correct.
A lot of great information there that folks can go to and learn more about your candidacy. At the website, you say the number one issue facing Vermonters is the economy.
Yeah.
And you address this in a number of ways. Mm-hmm. One is to call for a statewide public transportation system.
Which I've been plugging for years, by the way.
So what do you have in mind?
I've actually been discussing this with the Director of Rural Community Transit to develop my proposal. What I'd like to do is to finance a shuttle, a Route 7 shuttle from St. Albans down to Bennington, and then do the Route 15 loop, and then expand Rural Community Transit's budget so that they can expand their services. You know, there's rural community transit as much as there is mass transit for urban inner cities. It's a myth that public transportation doesn't belong in the country. As a matter of fact, Vermont, on average, Vermonters travel twice as far. And they're spending around, according to the American Automobile Association, an average of between $700 and $800 a month at the rate of 41 cents a mile to drive 49 miles a day. So Vermonters are transportation challenged, and transportation is the second largest expense of the average household. The top third of the population take transportation for granted, and that happens to also include the policymakers. But I've been out there on this issue, and there is a lot of support for this.
You also at your website talk about the need to have a massive infrastructure project to rebuild roads and bridges.
That's right.
Part of your transportation initiative.
Yeah, this would be nationwide. Obviously, we are the poorest rich country in the world. We're falling apart. There are thousands of articles that have been written over the past 10 years about our crumbling infrastructure. So we need to rebuild America. It's that simple. It's a consensus. And at the same time, I think statistics show that this is becoming the number one issue There's a lot of resonance about that. We hear more and more people talking about it because they drive down the road. They experience it from their personal experience. You know, their front end is torn up because the condition of the roadway, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, how much money would that cost and how would you pay for it?
It's similar to what's already being called for on the national level by both candidates actually have said the same thing. They're calling for hundreds of millions of dollars. I would say I would agree with them that we need that substantial type of an investment in our infrastructure, which will also get the sector of the economy going. The heavy manufacturing with steel, concrete, et cetera, which has been losing out on this recession we've had lately.
Also at your website, you say that Senator Leahy betrayed the voters' trust by supporting Hillary Clinton over Bernie Sanders for president. Now, Leahy says he made that endorsement very early in the process. He made that commitment to Hillary Clinton more than 2 years ago.
I know.
So how is that betraying the public trust?
I'm glad you asked. When I went out and got my signatures, I had lots and lots of feedback from voters on Senator Leahy. Now, he's trying to play it down, obviously, and you are too. He's trying to get ahead and around that issue, but he knows darn well, and so do astute political scientists know, the effect of his early endorsement on the influence, because he is one of the most influential men in the Senate. He's got buddies there. Look, this is no joke. You know, I think it's appalling. I think there's no excuse. It's nothing more than political cronyism, which it's time to put a stop to. Okay.
I'm certainly not trying to play it down.
Yeah, I know you're not.
I'm just suggesting that perhaps Senator Leahy feels that Hillary Clinton is a better candidate than Bernie Sanders. Isn't he entitled to that belief?
He's entitled to that opinion. But he owes the voters of Vermont his support for what they want. That's what he owes them, aside from his opinion.
Let's take a look at the EB-5 program, something else that you want to take a look at.
Yeah.
That federal EB-5 program has been at the center of the alleged fraud case up in the Northeast Kingdom. Senator Leahy says this program should not be renewed unless there are further reforms in the program. What's your position on this program?
Okay, let's start with Senator Leahy, who's on the public record as saying he – first time he heard about this was earlier this year in the Vermont Digger article. He was interviewed. To me, that's an admission that there was absolutely no oversight. None. Zippo oversight since 2012. This is simply inexcusable. Inexcusable, inexcusable. Now, those of you who don't know it, Senator Patrick Leahy has been the biggest champion of the EB-5 program since its inception. Obviously, now he's trying to get ahead of that, and he's saying, well, we're going to end the program if. Well, I'm saying we're going to end the program anyway, and I'll tell you why, because there are two other reasons why, other than Senator Leahy. One is the massive abuse taking place across the country. In New York City, in The Real Deal, there was an article, you know, they're building luxury housing that they don't need with EB-5 money. This is ridiculous. But last but not least, it's a wide open door for anyone who might be a nefarious character, member of a mafioso, to buy their way into this country, or even worse, a well-funded terrorist. This, for those of you who are just learning about the EB-5 program, what it is, it's an immigrant visa program in which you can buy your way into this country with no process other than, hey, here's the dough. You know, so that's what I think about EB-5. Now, I got to say, the Newport crater, which is what they're calling it, that is appalling. That, you know, they didn't even have a single architectural drawing there. Okay, they did not have a shred of a plan. All they had was a public relations scheme called the Newport Renaissance. And so what did they do? They go in and they demolish almost half of the downtown, creating displacement, disruption of businesses and residences. In addition to the money, what we have here is a physical result of this scandal, which is inexcusable. So I'm saying let's do something about Newport, Vermont. What do you say to that, Senator Leahy? What should we do about this crater now that we've got one? Should we build a swimming pool?
Well, do you think it is Senator Leahy's responsibility to provide the oversight for that program?
Yes, I do. Because I'll tell you why. Because he claims credit for all of that federal money he brings into this country. That's what politicians do. They claim credit to make themselves look good, and you can't have it both ways.
So Senator Leahy, as you are well aware, has more seniority than almost every other member of the U.S. Senate. And down in Washington, seniority usually means power. Mm. If that's the case, why should Vermonters reject Leahy?
Well, other than the aforementioned issues, his classic 20th century pork barreling, squandering the tax dollars, flying F-35s around in the sky, zoom, zoom, zoom. I tell you, that's nothing more than joyriding and it's a pure and simple waste. Now, to get to the point, what we need to do is we need wise investment in what we need. That's what we need. Let me say this also, those of you who are listening. The last time I ran in a presidential election, I got 10,818 votes, which is twice as many as the next other third-party candidate. It was actually the Green Party. I had spent no money. All I did was send out press releases, was virtually ignored, but then I did get an interview in Vermont Public Television. So that one interview on the debate, I'm sorry, got me 11,000 votes. So what I'm saying to you is very simple. Check my website, call the hotline, help me out now, spread the word. Word of mouth is still the most powerful form of advertising. So please help me in my campaign if any of this means anything to you, because I'm voting for you. Okay, I'm voting for the public. That's who I'm voting for.
What's your position on gun control? For instance, expanding the background check system to include all gun sales. Would you support that?
Well, I would. I think a background check is common sense. I would like to point out, though, that we don't have a problem in Vermont. Vermont is the second lowest crime rate in the country. Most people in Vermont hunt that use guns, hunt to bring more food to the table. So gun violence doesn't seem to be a problem in Vermont. Now, there is domestic violence. That's a separate but related issue. But, you know, people are hollering up, as usual, the politicians are trying to use this as a political football to get elected. That's what they're doing. Do they really care about this? You know, I have to say I'm a bit of a skeptic about that. But I do support common sense solutions that are actual solutions. What I don't support is political grandstanding on an issue and phony solutions that don't work and take away our rights.
So where does the idea of having universal background checks, is that a phony solution or a real one?
No, that's I think that makes some sense, background checks.
How about banning semi-automatic assault weapons?
Well, that might make sense too. But I have to say what I'd like to do – if I had my druthers, I'd take a look at the whole issue. I'd look at the black market. We'd try and trace the money, and we'd try and spend more resources on tracking these gangs, because that's the real problem here. In areas where there's an excess of gun violence, the irony is that if you legislate, it doesn't affect the black market. So what are we going to do about the black market for guns?
Let's look at the issue of terrorism. I'm curious, what are your thoughts about the growth of ISIS and whether or not this group poses a security threat to the United States?
Well, I can't say that I know for sure that it does not pose a threat. I think our own mistakes in foreign policy also pose a threat. You know, creating a power vacuum, which is what we did when we invaded Iraq, is the root cause of this problem. But I think the real solution to the problem of global terrorism is to build cooperative efforts between nations, to chase the money, not these quack cure solutions that politicians are, you know, like to promote so that they can get elected. You know, it's the politics of fear.
And the situation in Syria is also
– it's a civil war. And obviously we have been – if anyone looks into this, we have been supplying proxies, which may have also included ISIS, to fight the Assad, who is Russian-backed. So this is a complicated, stupid mess, but it is a civil war. And we're on record as being against the current regime and against the Russians. I'm still almost called them the Soviets, you know. But, so that's got to stop.
I want to come back to a domestic issue, and that is back in March, President Obama nominated Judge Merrick Garland to the United States Supreme Court, but Senate Republican leaders have refused to take up that nomination. Should the Senate vote on this nomination this fall, and would you vote for him?
Well, I haven't taken a close look at his record, but after I did, I would consider voting for him if I had the opportunity to. So this, we need a Supreme Court, and it shouldn't be subject to political maneuverings.
Well, once again, we want our listeners to know, if you'd like to learn more about Jerry Trudell's campaign, go to his website, jerrytrudellforsenate.com. Jerry, we really appreciate you coming in and talking with us today.
I appreciate my 10 minutes of fame, and I thank you very much for an excellent interview.
That's Vermont Edition for today. Tomorrow on the program, we continue our series of interviews with the candidates for the U.S. Senate. We'll be joined by Republican Scott Milne. Send your questions and comments to us at vermontedition@vpr.net. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Sengary, Sam Gale Rosen, and Meg Malone. Mary Williams directed the program. Our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Bob Kinzel. Thanks for listening.